Common Sense Conversations is a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Independent, nonpartisan, facts, and common sense since 1995.
Hello, and welcome to another Common Sense Conversation. I'm Steve Ellis, president of Taxpayers for Common Sense, TCS for short. As you know, we're the nonpartisan budget watchdogs who read the bills, go through the details, and follow the money to see how wisely government is or isn't spending your money. You may have noticed that we took last month off. That was in part because of us to COVID-19. And like everybody else, we started working from home and quarantining in early March and just adjusting to that work environment and doing this through a Zoom call. It just took us a little time. Besides that, as we're going to get into, Congress has been quite active in this time frame, at least for shoveling dollars out the door. So one thing I also want to share is, as I mentioned, we're teleworking. All of your beloved staff at TCS are healthy and that we're hard at work on behalf of you, the taxpayer. Today, I'm joined by my colleagues, Josh Sewell.
Happy to be here.
And Wendy Jordan.
Proud to serve.
So before we dig into the meat, we're going to talk a little bit about what we've been doing. As I said, working remotely, we've been trying to track a lot of these packages and this legislation. And Josh, if you could give us some sort of an understanding of what we've been doing and how people can follow along this huge volume of data.
There has been a lot that's been going on over the last, I guess now 2 months since the Congress really started its first response to the COVID-19 pandemic. With this fire hose of information that's been coming out of Congress and just the media in general, what we decided to try and do is to get an understanding of all the legislative packages and all of the administrative responses that are occurring, but then to shine some light on some good transparency in these actions to try to make it a little more understandable for folks out there who don't necessarily have the time to follow every detail. So one of the first things we did is created this thing that we call an industry tracker. We went through and tried to find as many of the industry-specific requests we could find from interest groups or from specific companies that were coming in saying, we are having these economic losses from COVID-19 and we need federal assistance. And so we just started hoovering up as much information as we could. We take the request and you can come to our website and you can see both in a downloadable spreadsheet format and in a web user-friendly format, our breakdown of these requests. So what's in it is basically, say, Boeing or the aerospace industry, they each made separate requests. We have their letter that they publicly released or that we were able to find, and it says, these are our economic damages. This is the justification for what we need. This is the dollar amount we need, and if there's any sort of specific program that they want. We have it all in one spot so you can see what these various industries and the various sectors within those industries are asking for. And the goal is then to see which ones of those get into the legislation and then how that spending goes out the door. We've really started our response and tracking by going industry specific.
I'm one of my favorites, the confectioners were asking for bailout funding. I mean, it's dozens of different industries that have been making these requests.
Pretty much anything you can think of. The Moving Industry Association, in ag in and of itself, which we can talk about in a little bit, we have over like 53 different specific requests for 53 different commodities, you know, everything from apples to wine. And so it's a pretty eye-opening insight into the world of lobbying here in DC. We're learning about things I didn't know about, I think, in some respects. I didn't know we had some of these associations, and I've been doing this for a while.
We've all been doing this for a while, Josh, and this isn't our first bailout rodeo. We certainly did actions after 9/11, looking at some of the tracking that, and certainly after the Great Recession and TARP and response there. This is still unprecedented in its size and scope. I mean, the fact that how much money has gone out the door, how quickly, and to put a little bit of meat on those bones, I'd ask Wendy to talk a little bit about what is some of the stuff that's in these huge packages that have moved forward.
Thanks, Steve. Josh was talking about the fire hose of information. There's also been a fire hose of money going out the door, mostly on the deficit plan. They started slow in Congress. The four pieces of legislation have moved since middle of March. First one was a mere $8.2 billion, more than many, many federal agencies get in the course of a year. Then we ramped up to $192 billion for the second package. Then the big kahuna was the CARES Act at the end of March, and that was $1.7 trillion. And then the fourth package, which will not be the last package, but the fourth package fell back a little bit and was $483 billion. That's a lot of numbers. That's a lot of dollars. I would recommend to people that they go to our website, taxpayer.net, and take a look at a one-pager that Josh put together called the Federal Taxpayer Costs of COVID-19 Response. People who want just a quick tutorial in what this all adds up to, that's a great resource for folks. So I strongly recommend you take a look at that. Also on our website, you'll find links to each piece of public law that resulted from the legislation. We, of course, have hanging out there the bill that was passed by the House at the end of last week, the HEROES Act, the Health Economic Recovery Omnibus Emergency Solution, HEROES Act. And that is in the neighborhood of $3 trillion. That was the first of these packages that was drafted, as far as we can tell, without input from the administration. So it's really a negotiating position, I would say. And there's a lot of things in there that will probably not end up in the final package for whatever the fifth version of COVID relief will be. That's a basic rundown. There's not just money out the door, but also things like loan guarantees, the Paycheck Protection Program, the loans to small businesses that will probably end up actually being grants to small businesses, assuming that they meet certain requirements. So it's a lot of stuff. It's a lot of money. And it's things that we believe taxpayers should be paying attention to.
Yeah, I think that there's like three different types of funding that's happening in here. There's money that's going to the agencies through regular programs. So you have that. You have the money that's like the Paycheck Protection Program that you mentioned, which has gotten hundreds of billions of dollars, I think about $700 billion in aggregate between both the CARES Act and then the bill after that. And then you have some of these revenue type provisions as well, or in this case of some of the checks that are going out to individuals. And so you have kind of these different categories. But here's the other question. You have such an unprecedented amount of cash going out the door. What have policymakers done to watch that cash? We know that people, no matter what the tragedy is or situation, people will take advantage. We've already seen that, you know, not necessarily with the government response, but with like fake antibody kits and people bogus masks and stuff like that. So what has Congress done to try to track all of that and make sure the money is being spent wisely and appropriately, Wendy?
You know, it's interesting to me. The U.S. government spends a lot of time planning and preparing for certain types of emergencies. Although there is pandemic preparedness, there seems to be less thought that has been put into how will Congress maintain its oversight role, its legislating role in a world where people aren't supposed to get too close to one another. It's a different type of emergency. And I think Congress needs to get themselves together and say, okay, this is really how we're going to do this, because that's the world we're living in now. And if Congress isn't working, then the congressional side of oversight, the hearings, the questions to the administration are almost impossible to do. And the act of legislating to fix problems that arise when this much money is going out into the United States is bogged down by the fact that Congress is like spinning its wheels trying to figure out how are we going to do this. That's one side of oversight. Then you have the internal oversight within the executive branch by the inspectors general. And in the CARES Act, the inspectors general in various departments where a lot of money was suddenly going to be spent, in particular the Small Business Administration, the Treasury Department, organizations that were having to approve loans, the inspectors general for those agencies received increases in their budgets. And it was all in all about $175 million was added to the IG budgets in those departments. I think it was 11 different agencies.
I think it was 15, actually, 15? When you account the special inspector general that they created for the bill.
But at the same time, so you're adding money to the IGs to oversee the money that's going into the economy. You set up the PRAC. Steve, remind me what PRAC stands for.
Pandemic Response Accountability Committee. And they actually have stood up their website. It's a pandemicresponse.gov, so that people can go and see. But they're not going to actually have up information about contracts that have been awarded or who's actually getting the cash until June.
Right. So you have all those things being done. That's great. And then you have this separate track that is thankfully not going unnoticed, where the inspectors general are being fired. They are, at least under the inspector general statute, what happens is you get 30-day notice that you're about to be fired. And that the trigger has been pulled on four IGs, the intelligence community IG, the DOD IG, the State Department IG, and the HHS IG. So that's a little alarming that that's going on behind the scenes. At the same time, we need to be having more oversight. So all that is alarming.
Yeah, no, absolutely, especially because the PRAC, the actual committee, is made up of the inspectors general. I mean, that's right. That's actually the committee membership. I mean, they have hired an executive director and a deputy executive director. There's also the congressional oversight committee as well that has...
They just had a report that came out today, didn't they? Their first report?
Yep. It's available at Senator Toomey's website, who's one of the members, along with Representative French Hill, Representative Donna Shalala, and another private sector gentleman. I can't recall his name off the top of my head. They are also doing their work. And then there's a select committee in the House as well that is supposed to be doing oversight. So hopefully, you know, one of the things that we really appreciated as part of the stimulus that came out, the American Recovery and Relief Act, was the creation of the RAP board, the Recovery Act Transparency Board, that had recovery.gov, which was a very useful tool that you could say that something was being wasted on a particular project, but at least you knew exactly where the money was going, who was getting it to do what, and you can then argue about whether it was a good use of taxpayer dollars or not, but at least we had the same data going forward. Speaking of oversight and accountability, Josh, there's been some alarming stuff that have come out regarding the agriculture and some of the ag spending and then some of the what the Secretary of Agriculture is able to do.
There are a lot of unprecedented actions that are occurring right now because this whole pandemic is an unprecedented occurrence, and it's an unprecedented threat to both people and to our economy. And so one of the things that has been different this time than, and I say this time compared to the last time we had a deep economic recession in 2008, I've observed a willingness for people throughout the political spectrum and ideological spectrum to get a little outside of their comfort zone and try some things that are a little different. And so I think transparency and accountability are really important to ensure that we continue to move forward in a sort of united front. And so one of the things we've seen is I think that's fraying a little bit in the responses in agriculture. And I point specifically to this is sort of grew out of our own industry tracking. Again, the reason we're doing an industry specific tracking is because one of the principles that we have in effective emergency response is that one, you should prioritize effective response and you should not use emergency legislation to make permanent policy changes. Because what ends up happening is these permanent policy changes end up being on these emergency packages, things that either could not or did not get through the normal process because they're either egregious or they're very costly or they're just not a priority. And so COVID-19 is a significant threat to agriculture in the United States. Exactly how much of a threat? Exactly what is going to be the cost? A lot of that is up in the air. And what is that? It's created the situation where you've had every type of commodity or crop or a sector of agriculture come in with a specific ask. Some of them are pretty broad and like other industries or like other businesses. And other are really specific to what people are growing. And so unfortunately, it appears that, so in the CARES Act, Congress included $9.5 billion in emergency income subsidies given to the Secretary of Agriculture with a few directions, basically trying to prioritize the folks who were most affected by COVID-19, folks in agriculture who had the most direct loss. And then they did this other thing that said, and here's, we're going to wipe $14 billion of debt off of this thing called the Commodity Credit Corporation. And the CCC, as it's known, is basically it's a paper corporation. It's a financing tool that the USDA uses to make payments, to fund payments in programs that are authorized by the Farm Bill, but then also to fund programs that are in these emergency bills where Congress just says, here's your authority to do something, use as much money as you need to achieve this goal, and go through the CCC. Well, there's the $30 billion line of credit. So once all these programs reach $30 billion, the USDA can't do anything else until Congress comes back and either gives them more money, like they did, or they reimburse that line of credit with the Treasury. But unfortunately, it appears in the CARES Act to a certain extent, but especially the HEROES Act, we're going down this path of Congress, instead of making these hard decisions about figuring out exactly how much money agriculture really needs, and asking the ag businesses and their lobbyists to document their losses, we're pretty much just deferring to the Secretary of Agriculture to say, here's you a huge pot of money, you figure out what needs to be happen, and just we'll pay the bill later. And so we are starting an ag industry specific tracker. And again, it's already on our website, going through each specific commodity and trying to figure out how much they've asked for and how much they really need. But in the way the legislation is moving, is you're going to see this point where Congress is basically abdicating not only their oversight role, but their appropriations role. The one power that is the primary power of the purse, which is Congress's job, they're deferring to the Secretary of Agriculture in a very expansive way.
This is not the first time the Secretary of Agriculture, and not just this Secretary of Agriculture, has abused this tool that they have. Am I right?
It's right. So the Commodity Credit Corporation Charter Act, which the Commodity Credit Corporation was started during the Great Depression by Franklin Roosevelt, and it was created its modern form under Harry Truman. So in 1948, basically, is when it became what it is now. And so it has this, one of the sections within the Charter Act says essentially that the Secretary of Agriculture could do whatever he needs to do in order to promote agriculture in the United States. And that is as broad as it sounds. And Congress has typically put some restrictions on it. Now, over time, secretaries have interpreted that to give themselves a little bit of leeway. And probably the most famous one, well, two most famous ones recently. The first one occurred back in the Obama administration when there just happened to be some significant disasters and emergencies for a few commodities. Most of them just happened to be grown in Arkansas, which was also the home of the then chairwoman of the Ag Committee, who was in a tough re-election. And so this Razorback kickback, as it was called, was pretty clearly done at the behest of trying to buy that seat. It was an unsuccessful bid. That's why we have a different senator from Arkansas instead of that senator. But then after that, there were some restrictions that basically said that Congress put on and said, you cannot use your authority to make direct income subsidies to farmers. You can use it to other things, but you can't actually try to buy a seat again. And that was there for the entirety of the Obama administration. And then when the Secretary of Purdue under President Trump came in, he behind the scenes lobbied to have that restriction lifted, and they did. And it was clearly done in order to do what has occurred for the last 2 years, which is the market facilitation program, which is the Secretary has used this Charter Act authority to make, without Congress's consent, without even having to tell Congress beforehand or afterwards, technically, they made a total of $28 billion in income subsidies to bail the administration out of its trade war ramifications in agriculture. So this is clearly, there's a precedent for spending a lot of money out of the CCC with almost no congressional involvement. And the CARES Act and the HEROES Act actually sets up potential for even more to happen, especially if they continuously reimburse for the losses that have already occurred or just shovel more large pots of cash without adding strings. And Congress has a role. If they want to, they can come in and say, you can use this authority, but you can only do it under these specific circumstances, and here are the reporting requirements. And there are a few in the HEROES Act, there are a few accountability measures. So unfortunately, the bill would expand the power of the secretary to do certain things under the CCC, but then would require he tell Congress 90 days before he does it. And it sets up a reporting mechanism for the Government Accountability Office So the reporting and the accountability are good. The expansion of power, not so much.
Just to underscore something that Wendy said before, I mean, the HEROES Act is, it's kind of almost a marker by the House Democrats. It didn't get bipartisan support, and it didn't get even the whole Democratic conference to the caucus to vote for it. It's something where, and Senator McConnell's been pretty down on assistance to states and to localities, something will eventually get done. And again, this is just kind of putting their stake in the ground, because the CARES Act was mostly it started out as pretty much just a Senate product. And then the House was able to modify that.
It's also important when you start drilling into the details in these bills, the bills that are dead on arrival, those ideas never die. And so it's pretty clear in agriculture that a lot of all the debates that are occurring over these emergency legislation, they're going to set the ground rules for the next farm bill, which is only about 2 years away, if even that far away. And so it's not just agriculture, but in the other areas, the debates that are occurring now and the ideas, they're going to pop back up not just in the next emergency legislation, but also in the next authorizing legislation down the road. So it's important to keep an idea and watch on those too.
Yeah, and the HEROES bill, 1,815 pages. So there's a lot there to read, and you can certainly glean what the House Democratic position is going to be on a lot of issues by going through that legislation and looking at it like we've done.
Absolutely. And I hope that you, our faithful listeners, will check out some of that work on our website, taxpayer.net. And soon we'll be adding to that also as money flows out, the contracts and who are some of the awards, and tracking, comparing what are some of the government decisions to some of the industry requests. And so kind of seeing a little bit of that interplay. You can be sure that there's all this work we've done related to COVID-19 was unanticipated. We're still doing our regular work as well. And I mean, because government continues to operate, and yes, they've appropriated trillions of dollars, but government annually spends trillions of dollars as well. And so we still have that responsibility. And so we're going to keep doing these common sense conversations. Feel free to send questions for future conversations to president@taxpayer.net. Josh or Wendy, do you have anything else to add or you want people to know about?
Actually, I forgot to note that in the HEROES Act, the House Democrats put down a marker for far greater protections for the inspectors general. No doubt in reaction to some of the things that are going on right now with the inspectors general, there would be enhanced notification to Congress before you could remove an IG. And there's a very specific list. It would amend the IG statute to put in a very specific list of the only acceptable reasons for firing an IG, including, you know, if they have committed a felony, malfeasance, if they are suddenly physically or mentally incapacitated. So you couldn't, in the future, an IG could not be removed simply because somebody got upset with them. So that's an important thing. I'm hoping that will survive in some form. I think all of us at TCS hope that'll survive in some form.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think the one thing I would say is that I think it's important for us to note is that, you know, those of us at TCS, I can speak for all of us, I think, in this, that we know people personally who've been physically affected by COVID-19, who've had it. And we've seen the economic devastation, not just at the national level, but on a personal level for some of us. Like we know people who own small businesses who are threatened to go out of business. We know frontline workers. And so we're deeply concerned with how the spending is going to affect the policies we work on. But that's because we're deeply concerned on how it's going to affect us and you and everybody. And so, again, one of the things I think is still there is that there is definitely some increased partisanship. You can argue about some of these policy responses right now, but I think that spirit of bipartisanship and focusing on what really matters in this time right now, that's still there amongst people. We need a little bit more of that in Washington, I would argue. I think some of us are taking our eye off the ball here. We're not. And so we just need your help to make sure your elected members know that we are all still in this together, and we just need to figure out how to move forward in a responsible way that helps people and helps the economy. Because it's not a partisan issue. It's really not.
No, it's not. It's not. So thanks, Josh. Thanks, Wendy. On a final note, I wanted to just flag that this has been an unprecedented response because it's been an unprecedented challenge facing the country, but it really underscores that when times are good, you shouldn't be overspending or cutting revenues. And so, you know, we're dealing with this because we have to deal with it and we have to have trillions of dollars in response, but it's made more difficult because of our deficit and debt situation that we built up when times were good and we should not have been doing it. And so even before this happened, we had a debt level as a percentage of GDP we hadn't seen since 1946. So after World War II, which was again an unprecedented challenge and something that the country had to face. So please check out our website, taxpayer.net. We continue to update it on the COVID-related items. We continue to do, like I said, our day jobs, looking at national security policy, agriculture policy, energy and natural resources, budget and tax issues. Please stay healthy, stay safe, and stay in touch. Thanks.
You've been listening to Common Sense Conversations, a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. To find out more about us, go to www.taxpayer.net.